Okay, so thank you, George, for the introduction, and also would like to take the opportunity and thank the organizers and all who made this very lively and interesting workshop be available and come alive. Also like to thank for having me here and giving me a chance to at least present some of the things that we are doing. So this talk is going to be on magnetic transport in one-dimensional systems, and as you may realize, most of the stuff is going to be rather on Heisenberg systems, but to give some training to the topic of this workshop, at the end there's going to be a Kitaev chain. All right, so this work has been done in collaboration primarily with my postdoc, Robert Kitaev in Braunschweig, who has now moved to Osnabrück as a junior professor, and my colleague Jochen Germer from Osnabrück, who was kind of interested in the quantum statistical foundations of what we are doing. But I would also like to give credit to collaborations with Xenophon Sotos and Jacek Kerbel from the University of Crete. They have been involved in some of the stuff that I'll be not talking about particularly today, but in relation to testing the method that I want to present. And finally, all of the time-dependent VMRG data I'll be presenting today will come from the Berkeley and the Munich groups, so Kayash and Heinrich Meister, so special thanks to them. So we get some funding I'd like to acknowledge. Okay, so what do we want to transport? So we want to transport either spin or energy density, right? Obviously, spin density does make sense only in a model which has SU2 invariance, but anyway, if you have the corresponding conservation laws, you can get currents from them, so either vector chiral type of currents or scalar currents for the energy density. And if you would have SU2 invariance, you could also play with an external magnetic field to get some interesting magnetothermal transport effects, which I'm not going to focus on today, but we also look at them. All right, so this is what we transport. Now, why would you want to transport after all? So roughly speaking, let me, for this first slide, just use a basic kinetic approach and stay with heat transport for a second. Then obviously, the heat transport would tell you something in a convoluted way about the elementary excitations of the system. Not as direct as Arpis, but in some way, you would learn something about elementary excitations. And secondly, you would learn something about scattering, so either extrinsic or intrinsic scattering of those elementary excitations. So that this is not just words. Let me just walk you through some experimental evidence of such magnetic transport with an emphasis on not so conventional excitations. There are other examples also, but I want to focus on that here. So first, in one dimension, it shows a copper oxide chain material, has some weak interchain frustrated couplings, but doesn't order down to the temperatures, at least measured on this scale. And this shows the heat conduction of that material. So there's a in the direction of the chains. So there's a kind of a Fonon bump here. But then after that, the heat conductivity just goes linear with temperature. And so if at all we know for some particular systems that spins definitely are fractionalized, then in one dimension. And so for those cases, we would then expect that fermions actually describe the heat transport, i.e. spinons. And indeed, that would match up with this linear heat conduction. Now, you might be so bold as to extend this to other models where we believe or hope that we have spinons alive. And as we heard last week, maybe the triangular lattice is such an example. And there are some organic materials around which are made out of these molecules. And depending on the actual system, they are called ET or TTF. And depending on this, they have rather isotropic or anisotropic couplings in the 2D plane. And this is, again, heat conduction versus temperature for those systems. Now, one of those ET type of systems shows a rather linear behavior here. And if you invoke, say, your most favorite U1 gauge liquid on the triangular lattice, at least on the lowest level, this would account for the linear dependence. But then
the linear part is on that plot? Is that
say again?
The linear part on that plot is actually the TQ piece.
Yeah, yeah.
The linear part is the intercept.
Right. So, Leon is absolutely right. I mean, Leon has been in this game for quite some time. So he knows that the intercept is
the
most
plotted gap over time.
Right. So, yeah. So maybe, okay, for non-specialists, this is kappa, or this is kappa over T. Right? Okay, thank you.
Kappa over
T.
So it's the offset here, while it's the linear part here. Anyway, so coming back to this result, if you believe that anything of this is right, you would have to involve gauge fluctuations. And gauge fluctuations will strongly modify the temperature dependence, giving rise to a T over 3/2 dependence. Now that obviously you don't like in terms of this experiment, so you invoke impurities. That may give troubles with the experimentally determined mean free path, but let it be like that, then you would have linear T dependence again. If you don't want to go this path, you might invoke, a nodal type of spin liquid with gapped gauge fluctuations. So then you don't have the problem with these energy renormalizations. You get a linear dependence right away. But then there are no real evidences for these kinds of liquids on the triangular lattice, at least as we learned from Federico last week. Now, finally, there's also a material which essentially shows a truly gapped behavior. And for this system, people then, invoke gapped liquid scenarios, where then the conductivity is essentially driven by the Z2 vortices. So you have bison-like activated heat conduction. All right, so if this is really the truth for this system or not, depends on to whom you talk. And also, depending on which experiments you believe. So, for example, an important experimental information is lacking here. The conductivity transfers to the plane is still not present. So, one would like to see that to have more solid evidence. And some of the off-diagonal transport coefficients, which should also be present in these materials, have not been in these theories have not been measured yet. So, but let it be like that. And let's move on to yet another case now in 3D, where the visibility of non-trivial elementary excitations in a quantum spin system are clearly visible, maybe in the spin ice materials. So there we kind of are rather sure that we have monopole type of excitations. So if you're lucky enough and you have a non-magnetic stoichiometric a compound, then you can subtract, so to speak, the phonon background from your actual magnetic or whatever spin-carrying material, and then you get a tiny blip in the heat conduction. And then I should actually cite Branwell et al. Here for kind of dipyhypal theories for the motion of monopoles in such systems. Then you can get a magnetic heat conduction, which obviously has a gap due to monopole excitation. So these theories don't really say anything about the motion, the kinetic energy of the monopoles, how that actually arises. So there are some effective theories. But anyway, you get a gap kind of behavior. The fact that it goes down again has to do with magnetoelastic coupling. At least that's what the authors wanted to be. Okay, so monopoles can be seen in thermal conductivity. And finally, let me come back to some materials which are is partially of interest also to this workshop. Just very recently, people have been able to measure pseudo spin heat conduction in the Strunson-Erieday. If you compare that to the, so to speak, real spin heat conduction, both of these are obviously ordered systems, then you see a D-square behavior of the heat conduction at low temperatures, and that would be indicative of magnons. So I hope with these kinds of things, you at least accept that from an experimental point of view, these kinds of things tell you something about excitations.
So that in a case like this, where whatever this non-lattice contribution is, nominally is very small,
yes.
How do we know, how can we tell, is there a sort of empirical way to tell whether it's really a separate excitation carrying the heat or just something else scattering? It's not something, maybe magnetic things are somehow scattering differently than lattice.
Certainly, coupling. between magnetic excitations and the lattice.
Yeah.
How very important in these things. I think very important. And obviously, then, even, I mean, you see this downturn here. And so I think the way to understand it, at least if you have some bias, is to say, okay, now I have this monopole, and they strongly couple to the lattice, and then at sufficiently high temperatures, you just see monopole phonon coupling in some sense. And the whole thing just gets some kind of mixed excitation. So obviously, on the basis of such hand-waving explanations, all of this is not clear. And then once you invoke strong monopole phonon coupling, then it's also not clear if this subtraction is really what you should do.
They subtract it by some other non-magnetic
analog. Right, so they just take the stoichiometric thing.
And then they probably have to scale it somehow? Do they scale
The times 5 just means
that. Something?
They don't.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly phonon subtraction is a very tricky game.
Yeah.
It's a very tricky game. And but I mean, there are two groups which kind of independently try to make something out of this experiment. And I mean, the Coulomb group has a somewhat different curve here. So there you can already see that subtractions are kind of carried out in a different way. But roughly speaking, this exponential rise and the downturn is in both. I agree. These are just indications. Huh?
Well, some of them are very dramatic. My first one you showed us, no doubt.
So now,
one more question about this figure.
Maybe
I missed the explanation. So why this this copper and iridium compound behave so differently?
You mean the signs?
Yes.
Oh, okay. This is a purity problem. So there are many things there. Okay, I should be very careful. We just recently have done other work for magnum systems, which kind of try to make quantitative explanations of these curves. So there are many things coming in there. First, it's the grain boundary size of the system, which kind of determines your low temperature onset. So the grain boundaries are totally different in these two systems. Second, it's the phonon spectrum, which kind of plays a role here in this temperature range, roughly around the bi-energies. And the phonon spectrums can be totally different. And eventually, the high temperature falloff is driven by correlation length effects. Physically speaking, you just have a finite correlation length, and your magnum just travels roughly the correlation length. So that sets another mean free path. And these three quantities, like grain boundary size, spin phonon coupling, and correlation lengths, are different. Even if you would say take a pseudo-spin model and exactly map that on what do we know about correlation lengths in 2D anti-ferromagnets, you still have a different J. So your correlation length has a different quantitative size, which will then make this curve come down earlier or with other quantitative numbers. But I would say this is kind of the very first thing you see to date. And also, these curves very strongly depend on sample quality. So this may change as a function of time. Right? Good. So, all right. So these are just basic kinetic stuff. So we want to go beyond that. The question is, what do we have to do to be something more unbiased than just quasi-particle or kinetic theory? So obviously, we have to do current correlation functions, if you do Fourier transform, contains two relevant pieces of information. There's a finite frequency thing, which describes how your currents may decay as a function of time. And for theoreticians, it's always very interesting. There can be a zero frequency piece, which tells you if your current is conserved, if parts of your current stay conserved, meaning that you have a Drude peak in your conductivity. All right, so for the Heisenberg chain, it turns out if you take just an energy density, which is defined via the nearest neighbor bond, then the answer is totally trivial, and we could all go home and skip the rest of the talk. The energy current just commutes with the Hamiltonian, meaning that on the basis of this type of energy definition, just the two-side energy definition, the XXZ chain is just an infinitely good heat conductor. All right? This is not so at all for the spin conductivity. So it's an infinitely good heat conductor, even though it's a strongly interacting system. This is not so for the spin conductivity. The only thing that you can say about the spin conductivity for the time being at this point of the talk is that if you would know all the conserved quantities of your Hamiltonian and you would be able to kind of calculate the operator content of the spin current in those conserved quantities, you could set a lower bound on the Drude wave, so the conserved part of the current. So it is known as Mazur's inequality and plays some role in this game. But that's about all we can say at present. So now, if you want to say something about these two quantities, you want to be unbiased. And so mostly people do numerical theories, either exact ionization or time-dependent density matrix renormalization group theory. Both of these theories have certain drawbacks and advantages. The first one has arbitrary frequency resolution, but obviously is limited to finite sizes. The second one has can be done on very large sizes. But it has restrictions regarding its frequency resolution because of entanglement growth. The time you can look at is limited. Okay, so today I would like to strongly advertise something that we have done which kind of lives in between. And I will hopefully try to convince you that this new method, which goes by the name of quantum typicality, can actually outpass TDMRG on various levels. Okay. So now coming back to the spin Drude wave for some time, we know, at least since more than 20 years, at zero temperature from famous beta Ansatz calculations, that the spin Drude wave is finite for all anisotropies of the XFC chain up to the isotropic point and at the isotropic point. Now, at finite temperatures, just like almost 10 years after that, average 10 years after that, people have started also looking at the problem. And there have been two seminal beta Ansatz calculations. And I'm showing you the Drude wave as a function of anisotropy from beta Ansatz calculation number one, which really goes to zero at the most correlated point, so delta is equal to one. And I'm showing you an asymptotic analytic expression from the second beta Ansatz calculation, which clearly is finite at the isotropic point. So this has led people in enormous amounts to work on this issue. And they are still working on it, if you look at this number here. And I have to say that I limited this by the premise that I didn't want to spend more than half of a view graph on it. So I apologize if I didn't put all of the names here, which kind of extend like almost 100 papers. And so the point is that roughly 50% of these calculations tell you that Drude wave is zero, and 50% tell you that Drude wave is finite. Just very recently, there has been an additional, I think, very important theoretical development by looking at so-called non-equilibrium eigenstates of master equations. This is a very formal thing which kind of mixes beta Ansatz and master equations. And people proceed to at least pinpoint some of the conserved operators in Mazur's inequality, and therefore give you a lower bound on the spin Drude weight of the XXC chain. And this is shown here in these two curves. These are improved versions of this method, so these nest bounds. And already from the structure of this curve, which is kind of fractal, you realize this has to do with math. And anyway, at the most important point, sadly or unfortunately, this method just gives a lower bound of zero. So the room of speculations on the spin stiffness or Drude wave remains. And so that's why I'm going to focus on that in the first part of my talk. So let me just briefly come back once again to experiment to substantiate the two things, infinite heat conduction and, well, some statements at least about spin conduction. So this again shows a quasi 1D Heisenberg chain material which can be nicely purified by making it very clean. And this shows all the three directions in the material for two different purities. And the directions transverse to the chain, which are those two lower curves, they are barely affected by purifying the system. So these conduction just kind of relates to phonons, while the conduction in the direction of the chain strongly changes with purification, clearly showing you that the magnetism somehow reacts to making the system more clean, and these things go up and get larger and larger. So for the completely clean system, we expect the infinite conduction. Just for those of you which are unfamiliar with the numbers, I put on this temperature scale the heat conduction of some simple clean metal. So here you have a stoichiometric Mott insulator, which where all the phonons are gone or subtracted in some sense or can be forgotten, and you have a heat conduction solely due to spinons, which is as large in a clean metal. So this is remarkable. The mean free paths, which you can calculate still in the kinetic picture from that, go up to micron sizes. And so these are, in a sense, device relevant dimensions. So people start thinking about building heat transistors with these things. So, regarding the spin transport, there's a kind of at least a grain of salt with respect to the experimental situation. Obviously, in a Mott insulator, there's nothing like a spin battery. So you don't know really how to inject spin. So up to today, people usually do spin conductivity measurements very indirectly by looking at, for example, NMR and extracting spin diffusion rates from the NMR rate, which is a very convoluted and, for me, very hard to quantize, to quantitatively make a point of view and approach. Anyway, there are theories which then relate the zero temperature offset in some NMR experiments to ballistic spin transport at low temperatures, claiming that this is somehow related to the spin Joule weight. But this is very, very indirect, and that's about all of the information we have experimented for spin conductivity on excess machines. All right, so now that I've spent some 25 minutes for introduction, I want to highlight what I will try to do for my remaining time. First, I want to tell you something about a method which we use to calculate the current correlation functions, which I think is extremely nice, extremely bold, and extremely effective. Then I want to use this method at least in one integral case to make a new point on the spin stiffness of the XNC chain. And then as much time as I have, I want to break integrability of that system and look at the dissipation of currents using numerical techniques. So let me start with this method here. Just two slides of technical stuff. So the concept of this method comes from a completely different area of some form of quantum statistical physics, where people make a strange statement, which I obviously have to fill with some meaning, saying that if you take certain single pure states of a quantum system, then these certain single pure states are enough to give you all of the information that you would obtain from the full canonical statistical ensemble. So what does that mean in our case? So we want to calculate this correlation function. So we have to trace over all states. So let me be so bold as to take a random, instead of doing this trace, take a random pure state. What I mean by random, I will say in a second, and calculate the correlation function just using this random state. Obviously, I will make an error. All right, so what is the random state? The random state is a state which is drawn from the full Hilbert space with a Gaussian distribution on amplitudes and uniform distribution on phases. So on the unit sphere of the Hilbert space, it is totally random. There are some formal details of so-called Haar measures and things like that, but let me not go into that. So now I hope that as a soft cell technique, you will all accept that the error that I will be making by doing that is governed by the law of large numbers, right? So it will scale with the square root of some large number. What is the large number? It is just the number you get from calculating the partition function. So in very high temperatures, it's essentially the dimension of the Hilbert space. So that means, and obviously also at finite temperature, it scales exponentially in system size. So there's a controlled way of scaling this arrow down. Now, obviously, you don't know about the quantitative size of this arrow yet, and I'm going to show you how large this arrow is. So what is the gain by doing something like that? Well, just keep this in mind, what is here, because now I can just take two pure states, rewrite. Okay, there's some resolution problem. So there should be a line here, which is on my screen, not on the projector. But this is fraction, and there's an error there. All right, now what is the gain here? The numerical gain is that in calculating this finite temperature, time-dependent correlation function, exact hybridization becomes totally unnecessary. You don't do it anymore. You just need to time-propagate two pure states. that you can do with anything you learned back at school. I'm going to show you there's no problem with norm conservation or whatever. And the only thing you need to store are these time-evolving two states and a sparse matrix representation of the Hamiltonian. So this gets rid of an n-cubed operation, which usually is the bottleneck to system size. And with that, we have been able to increase system sizes by approximately four orders of magnitude for full-spectrum, finite-temperature, time-dependent calculations, meaning that from the typically 20 or 22 spins that you can do in this case, we can go up to something like 30, 34, 36, whatever spins you have, depending on the system, without any restrictions. All right, so let me show you how this method works on this case of the spin
doing. You didn't say how this arrow scales once again, so what is the value?
Yeah, so I would actually show this by example now, but once again, so there's a prefactor, obviously, and the first thing that you could guess is that this prefactor is just enormously large, but it turns out it's essentially just, I mean, the square, so to speak, these two guys, and that's all. And the number is just the law of large numbers, so it's the effective dimension of the Hilbert space. And at high temperatures, this is all states, and as you go down in temperature, obviously, this effective dimension is just the trace, the partition function, the trace weighted by Boltzmann factor will go down, but it still scales exponentially with system size.
So the way you argue this thing is you expand psi in a basis of eigenstates, and then you write it out and say the thing is dominated by states of the...
Some typical states.
Yeah.
Some typical states. This is how you argue. Yeah. And, in a sense, it seems totally bold and trivial. The point is, when you look at it in actual real life, the errors turn out to be exceedingly small. And this was not what I expected.
But can you relax it at all? I mean, if you, instead of drawing a totally random state, can one, does it go horribly wrong if you don't draw a totally random state?
We haven't tried. What I know is that if you don't take a Gaussian distribution, take the box distribution, the errors increase. So it has to do with...
Smoothness is probably important.
But the choice doesn't depend on the temperature, the choice of the random state.
No, but I will show you what happens if you go down in temperature. Obviously, there are limitations similar to those which you have for any finite size system calculation. As you go down in temperature, things get worse. I will show you examples, depending on how much time the chairman allows. So I want to look at this current correlation function in the XXC case, just the Heisenberg chain. I'll walk you through using this method. So this shows decay curves or current correlation versus time. The blue curve is taken from our friends, or with the courtesy of our friends from Berkeley and Munich. So this is a state-of-the-art TDMRG calculation up to the times where it is available and where it has been published. And we take a small system and we do exact diagonalization. So, everyone knows that cannot reproduce TDMRG. So we see the current correlation as it departs from the TDMRG result at some time point, both for say, complete isotropy and a little bit above the isotropic point. So now the next thing is I want to show you that even if you take such a rather small system of 18 sites, just take a random state and look at this correlation function, what would be the error that you do? This is full spectrum, all states traced over the full partition function. So this is what you get when you take one random state, just one state. This is a log scale, So you should be aware there are some errors here, but they are tiny. Yeah, and telling you that just taking a random state already does what you do when you do full spec, when you do the complete exact randomization. Now, the first thing one might say is, okay, let's average over a handful of states to increase the accuracy. But that's not what we are going to do. We're just going to increase Hilbert space dimension and thereby reduce the error. And this is shown here. So now we go up from, this is, we now also have 34 sites for this particular case, but never mind. But the main point is here that a single pure state now reproduces TBMRG up to the timescales where TBMRG can be done as of today. And it's therefore also a proof of this quantum typicality method, clearly showing you it works. And again, not the log scale. Okay. So now, using this knowledge, we go ahead and do what the TBMRG has issues to do, namely, we go up to whatever times we want. So you see the current correlation function versus time for three different anisotropies. The thick curves are always results from Munich and Berkeley, and the thin curves are the quantum typicality. The dashed curve just shows you that if you evaluate the norm of the states as they propagate, there is no issue. The norm just stays one. So there is no such problem with loss of norm or things like that. So, okay, we can obviously reach the stationary kind of limit of the current correlation function. Well, I mean, the TDMRG, kind of like here or there, it's not really clear where you are. And so now...
That's not the connected correlator. Is it the connect? It's not, is it connected correlator?
It's the JJ correlation function.
Yeah. It's the JJ. No subtraction of expectation value.
Oh, there's no current at zero. I mean, there's no zero. I mean, the current is zero. The mean value of the current is zero. So in a sense, if you call that subtracted, it's a subtracted. So in a spin language, it's a connected six spin correlation function that you're looking at. So now this guy has an infinite time limit, which obviously still depends on system size. It will still depend on system size. So we need to do finite size scaling of something that we call the Judah weight. So we just average over some time window where things have converged out. This is the same thing that the TDMRG people do, but they have to confine themselves to a time window which is not really well set.
Is this real time or imaginary time?
This is real time. I'm going to show finite frequency results also later. Depending on time. Okay. So now this is a very busy view graph, which just puts all the results for Judah weights, which we have from full spectrum exact randomization, TDMRG, and the quantum typicality on one view graph for these three different values of anisotropy, scaling the Judah weight as a function of inverse system size. And obviously, there is no doubt that, I mean, there are some odd even oscillations here which die out, but there's no doubt that below the isotropic point and above the isotropic point, the results just scale to zero or to a finite value. But if you go to the isotropic point and I realize that this kind of is the limit at which full spectrum exact randomization could have or was done until kind of start of last year or mid of last year. You can clearly see that there is some kind of strange bending of the finite size dependence of the spin stiffness. And people have been biased, so to speak, to extrapolate that to a finite value. And people even have been doing that in papers where they combine exact randomization and TDMRG, kind of to match the TDMRG and ED results, and kind of have gone to this finite value. Now, if you add on this curve all the additional up to 34 spins that we have, then it is clear, I think, that this guy scales to zero at the isotropic point. And if we summarize all that...
Sorry, just a question. So, is there a simple way to understand why you expect one over L behavior?
That's a good point. But that's an extremely good point. Let me answer it this way. I recently talked to people from Vega Anderson conformal field theory groups, and they had a statement, why don't you know that maybe there's some strange log or thing going on down here? We don't. Right? So, I mean, if you want to add another, certainly with these results, you can now go on and add another number of 10 publications to this long list claiming that one should, you know, I mean, it's an integrable model, and strange things can happen.
It's very, very common to fit damn near everything to 1 over L, and especially in 1D. It's
I completely agree that this...
It says beta equals zero. It's infinite temperature, why it has anything to do with CFT or anything like that, I have no idea.
So this is the best.
Seems to kind of fit.
So actually, to add one more on that, to get this thing fitted, people have obviously used some windowed polynomial fittings with power laws, additional stuff, and so on. Yeah. But I think at least it is clear that you cannot continue this curve to a finite value. I think this is rather clear. So you're absolutely right. Okay, so now let me put all of that on one plot showing all the anisotropies that we looked at. The orange curve actually is the bound from the Ljubljana, so this non-equilibrium eigenstate bound. The open triangles are the TVMRG. These are quantum typicality results, one extrapolated to the infinite system size and one at the finite value, and finally the green is the beta results. And you can again clearly see that the TVMRG kind of goes off from the beta ansatz and the quantum typicality kind of as you approach the isotropic point. And we more or less lie both on the Ness bound and the thermodynamic beta ansatz calculations by Sotos, and follow them kind of until 0.5. And then things happen that nobody really understands. Yeah? So both BMRG and the quantum typicality tend to bend down from the beta ansatz. And actually, also the Ness lower bound has this behavior of underestimating the beta ansatz results in this range. And we don't really know what's going on there. In particular, it's very strange that the TDMRG and quantum typicality results jump back to the beta ansatz results exactly on the XY limit. And strangely enough, although it's not seen very well, the non-equilibrium eigenstate has one of these magical mathematical spikes exactly at delta is equal to zero, where it also pops up to this number. So it's not really understood what is going on here. It's again something which you may or may not be interested in.
So the beta ansatz, you said you mentioned there was another beta ansatz paper that disagrees. Beta ansatz people can't even agree among themselves.
So I understand that this is not an issue with beta ansatz. It's an issue with some approximations that you have to do when you solve integral equations. I'm not a specialist there. In terms of some, you know, strange states, things happen there, and it depends on what you do, what kind of result you get. So it's not an issue with beta ansatz. It's an issue about these integral equations.
What's an issue with beta ansatz?
So here's about finite temperature. Just very quickly saying what happens there, because I'm going to do that later on more extensively. So now we go down in temperature. First we take beta is equal to 1. So it's kind of a lower temperature. Now you can see, again, it's a carbon correlation function, that there is some larger difference between exact organization on finite small systems. This is again this 18 site or even 16 site system, and the quantum typicality. But as you increase system size, these kind of Whitney behavior dies out. Everything gets rather smooth, and on a linear scale, you cannot discriminate between 28, 30, and 32 sites. So again, this quantum typicality result works also at this, so to speak, lower temperature, beta is equal to 1, and it would indicate then, because you stay at a finite value for the correlation function as a function of system size, that if we scale, and I want to spare you from that, if we scale to the infinite system size limit, that at temperatures lower than infinite, we have a finite Grutter weight, which kind of agrees with some yet unpublished paper by Camilo and the Ljubljana group. Finally, if you lower the temperature even further, then it very much depends on the system that you're looking at. I'll come back to that later. You see here that at this temperature, beta is equal to 2. There's quite some stuff going on here. And obviously, this is like an exact quantization calculation. So at some point, finite size effects kick in, and you have a problem here. Okay. So now I want to break integrability. 5 minutes left? You mean talk time?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. I can extend to what time scale? I have to finish at 11 or?
So the 1 hour is the maximum it could be in the discussion. So if you extend the talks, then there will be
I will stop at 11. Okay, is that okay? Then we stop at 11.
Okay.
Don't ask questions.
Who are you looking at?
All right. So energy dissipation. Now I want to break integrability. So just very briefly, how do we break integrability? We put in a scattered field. Why do we do that? Well, because, again, there's TDMIG data available here. Just very roughly, mentioning what you should expect if you break integrability with such a magnetic field, a scattered magnetic field, perturbatively, you can always map these correlation functions to an expression which is perfectly general, but also perfectly useless in terms of memory functions, where the memory function describes a generalized relaxation rate. But in a perturbative sense, for small magnetic fields and sufficiently large temperatures, you can map this very general expression to something that you can handle in terms of known quantities. Namely, the decay of the current is kind of proportional to the forces which the external perturbation exerts on the current. So that's why these guys are called force-force correlation functions. And again, I have this resolution problem. The main point is that this commutator here, because of the B field, will scale like delta B squared. So your conductivity will diverge like one over B squared as you approach integrability. And it will also scale like one over delta squared. Divided by delta squared. Okay. So this is roughly what you can learn from perturbation theory. I want to briefly show how that arises with quantum typicality. This shows current correlation functions as a function of time for various magnetic fields, contrasting again quantum typicality up to the largest systems that we have in this case, so 32 sites, with TDMRG. TDMRG kind of stops here where the blue line is. It's not an error bar that is there, it's just how far you can go with TDMRG. And you can again see that if you go large enough with system size, there is no difference in the quantum typicality results. And so we believe what we get from just calculating correlation functions with a single random state. All right, the scaling is exactly as expected from perturbation theory, 1 over b squared. You can see that the decay times kind of vary as you vary the b field, getting smaller as you raise up the b field. And actually, you can also do the same thing with the delta scaling. And you can even see that in the large delta limit, it levels off at some constant value. So the scaling which you get from perturbation theory nicely is born out of also the exact calculations. So now we can do the same thing at finite temperature. And since my time is running, the only thing I want to say is it works at finite temperature down to a value of beta is equal to 5 for this particular case. So we can go to quite low temperatures. And I just want to skip to the result. So this shows what we get from Fourier transforming the time-dependent correlation functions into frequency space and then going to the zero frequency limit, since we have complete dissipation, and calculating the heat conductivity in this integrability broken system as a function of temperature. So at high temperatures, so this is a very busy curve, it shows blue the quantum typicality results using different time windows for the Fourier transform. This is just a detail. And green, the TTMRG curve. Now, the main point I first want to make, the difference between the TTMRG and the quantum typicality is not a finite size effect, which we have because we don't have large enough systems. It's just the other way around. It's a problem with the DMRG. They cannot go to long enough times, and therefore, if they do the Fourier transform, they lack large amounts of the current decay, and therefore they are always below our results. Now at high temperatures, there is, due to Onsager, there has to be some 1 over T behavior. At low temperatures, it seems that there's also a linear slope, although as you go to very low temperatures, the current creeps down very slowly. So it might be that actually, if we make the time window even larger, that kind of this curve comes up as we integrate over even larger times. So it is not quite clear how to fit an exponent to this line, although it is very tempting. So if you would fit an exponent to what we have here, then the exponent is certainly kind of like 1.4 or so, with a chance of getting a little lower as you have larger integration time windows. So there's no field theory available for this case. It would be very interesting to have one. There is field theory available for the spin conductivity, but not for the energy conductivity.
If a staggered field in, at zero temperature doesn't open up again, this is the Heisenberg point?
This is the Heisenberg point.
I would think a staggered field would open up again.
Certainly in the XY it does so. Certainly in the XY it does.
Heisenberg coupled to the staggered magnetization operator, which is small scaling.
So, but then the temperature scale is lower than that.
Yeah, so maybe you're not at those temperatures. Yeah. It's pretty smooth.
Well, that's you're absolutely right, but the temperature is not low enough potentially for that. Okay. Anyway, we can also Fourier transform the data, and the only point I want to make here is that the decay profile of the currents is not Lorentzian. So there is substantial frequency dependent of the current correlations going on. And since I anyway can only flash at least one result for the Kitaev, I want to take another 30 seconds to make a commercial about this curve. Just, you may be completely uninterested about the physics of this talk, but what you're looking at here is a six-spin correlation function, time-dependent, Fourier transformed for a strongly correlated, non-integrable, quantum many-body system, calculated without any bias, and clearly surpassing what people would call the gold standard for 1D systems, namely DMRG. Okay, commercial period. Now, Kitaev. All right. Kitaev has, so we want to break integrability by introducing Kitaev interactions. All right? So the Kitaev Heisenberg chain has two integrable endpoints, like the Kitaev limit and the Heisenberg limit. And in between, actually, there's a third one. And so we want to look at what the frequency-dependent energy conductivity in that case would result in. So we do, in this case, only exact quantization because we haven't used quantum typicality yet. The only thing I want to show is that obviously on the Kitaev side of this model, which is a little different from the planar Kitaev model in the sense that you still have Z2 invariance, but the Z2 invariants don't introduce additional energies to the model. So your energy spectrum still has an SZ as Z2 invariant, but that will not change the ground state energy of your sector. So the degeneracy of the model is even larger than on the plane, but you don't have any static gauges. Okay? But it still maps to a BCS, like a superconductor in a fermion language. You can calculate the energy correlation functions. It has a Drude peak in the Kitaev limit and some finite frequency behavior. Now there are two more integrable points. And since my time is almost up, I'm just showing those two. This is the Heisenberg point. And there's another point which we know from Jean's work happens for a particular set of Heisenberg and J1, J2, is here JX and JY couplings. At that point, you can rotate the Heisenberg-Kitaev model into a Heisenberg model. And therefore, the spectra at that two points look completely identical. Now, the first thing you check is that between those two points, the model gets non-integrable. You do that by looking at energy distribution functions, which actually do get Dyson-Wigner-like at some point in between. And then you calculate the energy current correlation function. It's just some result I want to show here. So off one of those three integrable points, the current correlation function does not have a Drude peak anymore, obviously, because the system is non-integrable, so that can clearly be seen. It has some rather stable, with respect to system size, finite frequency broadening of the Drude peak. So this is dissipation then that we see, the energy current correlation function. And one can clearly see remnants of this omega square behavior for the high frequency tail. So this is the typical spectrum of such a Kitaev-Heisenberg chain system. And some point where you are in the gapped phase, so this is obviously at the gappiest point, if you're in the gapped phase of the system, you can follow remnants of the equivalent of the topological gap. As you increase temperature, it gets filled in as you crank up the temperature consistent with the dimensions. We have done some magnetic field analysis and also other things, but I don't want to get the chairman completely mad at me, so let me summarize. I've tried to show you that there's a new method there. It's extremely bold. You can go home, even if you never did numerical physics, you can take a Python compiler or a Python thing. You don't need to worry about symmetries. You can easily go to 22, 24 spins, which people usually would have only done with full symmetry analysis and so on, calculate dynamical correlation functions. Obviously, if you want to go to 30 or 40 sites, you need to do more work. I tried to convince you that we have a new plane on the spin Drude weight. It's zero at infinite temperature. It agrees with one of the two beta ansatz calculations for quite some time. I've shown you one case of dissipation of the energy current due to integrability breaking with the staggered field, which surpasses EDMRG results. And I've tried to convince you that when you go off from the Kitaev point or off from the Heisenberg point into some Kitaev-Heisenberg model, then you will see low frequency dissipation and a high frequency omega square pseudo gap behavior. And I just would like to advertise that while I was here, we have been starting to do calculations also on Kitaev ladders, which then do have gauges, static gauges. And we are kind of pursuing a picture there that at intermediate temperatures, the gauges will kind of proliferate in the system and make a bunch of impurities. And on these impurities, your current will scatter. And that is really a fun game, because you have a temperature kind of determine the impurity density. And then this broadening will not only be due to a Kitaev-Heisenberg thing, but also happen at finite temperature in a pure Kitaev system. And with that, I would like to close.
Questions?
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have an experimental question, actually, as to the state of the art, so to say, how reliable are these statements that thermal conductivity is really due to spin excitation? Because I once remember when I collaborated once with some group in Russia, we had PRL on that, they studied one-dimensional system, and they saw peak thermal conductivity below magnetic orbit, or below some kind of orbit. Right? And the dilemma was either this peak is the due to magnetic excitations, or alternatively, it might be that main thermal conductivity is due to phonons, but the scattering is very strong at high temperature when spins are strongly disordered and strong spin rotation, so phonon conductivity, thermal conductivity is strongly suppressed at high temperature, and this suppression is reduced at low temperatures, which finally gives you a big peak of thermal conductivity. So what is actually the state of the art? How to discriminate between these two possibilities? Reducing of phonon scattering below magnetic orbit or extra contribution due to excitation.
So before I go to your question, let me just point out that in those examples which I have shown, phonons can clearly be discriminated from the magnetic contribution. So this is one of those systems where at some intermediate purity level, the C direction, so the chain direction, shows this kind of double peak structure, which in the out of chain direction can clearly be at least mapped to one peak to the phonons and the rest to something else. And when you start purifying the material, it is very clear that these two guys don't change at all, while this guy starts to grow. So I think that for those cases, but as you say, as you asked, this thing is not ordered, so it doesn't order. So once you have those systems where phonon and spin degrees of freedoms are on a similar energy scale, and where things start to order, and when you know that there is strong magnetoelastic coupling, I think you refer to the copper germinate business. I mean, we know that even nowadays people would argue about if this is really a spin piles or phonon piles type of thing that is going on. So if you have strong spin phonon scattering, then these kinds of reasonings are not as simple as that. And you might start thinking about some collective spin phonon object which carries heat and then gets also magnetic field dependent. But I've tried to stay with those cases which are clear cut. I understand that this question of spin phonon coupling is very interesting. And I think also experimentalists try to stay away from these materials where you have exactly the things that you're talking about, because I think disentangling phonon and magnetic heat conduction can be very complicated. And also Leon pointed out that in the pyrrhic laws, this is an issue. So I think the status is such that to finally answer your question, in the quasi-1D systems, people tend to go to systems where phonons and magnetic degrees of freedom are clearly separated in energy scales and where there's no order. And then you are kind of on the safe side.
So if you have a critical spin chain, I would tend to think that if omega and T are small enough, then the conductivity should be based on kind of omega over T scale. So can you see that?
So, as I said, for the heat conduction, you just have a delta peak. Right? So there is, that's the simple answer, you have a delta peak. For the spin conductivity...
And I guess there's a regular part, too.
Right, it's about the regular... Yeah, it has
a regular,
part,
probably.
Right, it has a regular... Okay, so now things get complicated. First of all, it may have a regular part. I tried to stay away from this nitty-gritty detail that energy densities are not really well defined. Right? And so you may have your favorite energy density. The question of the existence or non-existence of the judoid does in no way depend on this period, thankfully. But the finite frequency content depends on that. Roughly speaking, the physics is, if your particles can wobble around over a certain length scale, that will give some finite frequency content. So energy regarding the regular part is a murky business. spin conductivity regarding the finite frequency part is not. And there, people have looked at the scaling of the frequency of the regular part of the spin conductivity. And the simple answer is there is no agreement on what it would look like. So some people claim there's a pseudo gap, actually. So you have a Wooder peak, which I showed you exists at least at finite temperature, not at infinite temperature. And the question is, how does it kick off at finite frequencies? Bosonization studies claim that kind of you have the Wooder peak, and then attached to it, so to speak, at some finite value, you come in with the regular part. Exact ionization studies claim that you have the Wooder peak and a pseudo gap close to the Wooder peak. And there's no consensus on that. And so, I mean, these field theories by Sirka, Affleck, and Pereira are quite involved. And I think they also try to justify it with transfer matrix renormalization group calculations. So, again, there's a discrepancy with two numerical methods and this bosonization. So if you want to say something about the finite frequency regular part of the spin conductivity, you have a fair chance of getting a new result.
Okay, I would suggest to move on to the next speaker and thank the